serving for the non-localists. You see, you have to understand the starting point of this talk. There's been a wave passing over the Perimeter Institute under the influence of Travis Norson's papers and as spread by Rob Speckens, that quantum mechanics, that the Bell inequality violations are about non-locality. And I thought, well, since there would be so many non-localists at this meeting, it would probably be a good time for me to try to say what I think this looks like from the perspective of this thing called cubism that I'll tell you a little about. So I really want to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk double what we had originally intended. Maybe if I zip through this file, I'll be able to give you a relatively complete story of how this word locality, non-locality looks, these words look from my perspective. Non-localist, I should say, doesn't just refer to the visitors here, and I would guess you know that. You non-localists out there know who you are, and you know what you are. But you probably don't know what a cubist is, so let me just define that. It's a phrase that I've been using a lot lately, cubism. It refers to the quantum Bayesian program that Caves and Schock and Marcus Appleby and a few other people, not many, have contributed to. And if you want to learn anything about it, I'd say just go to archive.org and look up any of our papers, and you'll get a good dollop of the home cooking there. Another good place to look is this excellent article by Chris Timpson. Now, it's a pro and con article, so it's more balanced, but it's excellent reading. It's also on the archive. And also, Chris gave two talks here recently, and they're recorded on PIRSA.org. So that's the place to look and see what I'm talking about in detail. Here's going to be my strategy for the talk. The first thing I want to do is just share with you a kind of vague worry that I have. And you should treat it as that, a vague worry. And don't try to make me too precise on it. It just tries to convey the emotions that I feel when I hear the word non-local. And after that, I want to lay out what I mean by this cubist program in some detail, using lots of diagrams and cartoons, but I hope to convey what it's about to you. And after I get that fully laid out, the worldview of cubism laid out for you, or the nascent worldview, then I'll come back to the issues of locality, non-locality, really at the end of the talk. But I feel like I need a lot of prep work before I get there. So what is this point of view called cubism? Well, I think all of us up here on this list ascribe to... Oh, no, I shouldn't tell you that. I should tell you my vague worry first. Here's the vague worry. With the failure of local causality, what Bell said in his own vague way as the direct causes and effects of events are nearby in his article La Nouvelle Cuisine, my vague worry is not that the failure of local causality would contradict special relativity. It will contradict special relativity, but I don't know that I should be bothered by that. It seems that a lot of people put weight on rejecting non-locality as the rejection of local causality, because they have, as I think Antony Valentini kind of said, a feeling that special relativity and Lorentz invariance is sacrosanct. That's not my problem. My problem is more of a conceptual difficulty. Particularly, I wonder, if we don't have a principle like this, how do we draw lines in nature? I find it really disturbing, the idea that I wouldn't be able to draw at least some kind of lines in nature. For instance, I was imagining if I were to take my young bride to the honeymoon suite. We've just gotten married. We go to the honeymoon suite at the Waldorf Astoria. I'd like to think that we were really enclosed by some walls that were, to a large extent, impenetrable. And particularly, I'd like to think that in this very romantic and great moment, you know, of our marriage, that there's no one else romantically entwined with her. Well, if we can't draw lines in nature, we would never know. Now, one might say, well, she wouldn't know either, and you wouldn't know either, because we can't signal with these hidden variables. But I think to myself, well, the hidden variables would know. And if I were looking for some depository, some place where the soul resides in the body, maybe I'd look in the hidden variables so her soul would know. This sort of thing bothers me, the idea that we wouldn't be able to draw lines in nature. So that's the first trouble. The second trouble is that quantum mechanics seems, in its formal structure, to draw lines where the non-localists tell me, in the end, there are no lines. So what do I mean by that? Suppose I conceptualize two objects. I say, here's one chair, and here's another chair. And I'm going to start thinking about those two chairs physically. Well, quantum mechanics would tell me, write down two Hilbert spaces. Not one Hilbert space, but two Hilbert spaces. And put a tensor product symbol between the two spaces. Now I imagine that from this Hilbert space, I draw some quantum state, perhaps an entangled quantum state. Fine. Now, Bell tells me, Norsen tells me, that my actions on the left, when I have this situation, affect the things on the right. I can't signal with them, but my actions on the left affect the things on the right. Well, at that point, I think, why did I conceptualize two objects rather than one to begin with? It seems like there's some ultimate flaw in the idea of thinking that there are two things. Quantum mechanics in the end tells me that there's one. A violation of Bell inequalities tells me that in the end there's one. So I'm a little worried about that. It's a vague worry. I'm a little worried by the idea that I start with two things and then I seemingly have a proof that I've got one thing after all. But then I come back to quantum mechanics and I say, well, what's my Hilbert space for this one thing? My Hilbert space for this one thing is still split into a product of two things. So it looks like there's something iffy going on here to me, that somehow I'm getting part of the analysis wrong somewhere. If there is one thing, I should treat it as one thing. If there are two things, I should treat it as two things. And I shouldn't be sliding in between these two descriptions all the time. So that's my vague worry. And I'll come back to it at the end and try to firm some things up about it. But now let me start the process of telling you about this foundation's program called Cubism. There is one thing that it takes as sacrosanct. It certainly doesn't take Lorentzian invariance as sacrosanct. But it takes this quote by Martin Gardner as sacrosanct. And it's often forgotten in the discussions about us. The quote goes like this. The hypothesis that there is an external world, not dependent on human minds, made of something, and I emphasize something, is so obviously useful and so strongly confirmed by experience down through the ages that we can say without exaggerating that it is better confirmed than any other empirical hypothesis. Well, I like that quote. I agree with that quote. And as far as I know, Carlton Caves and Rudiger Schock and Marcus Appleby, we all agree with the quote. I think that some of you in the audience, as the talk develops, will say, he doesn't believe that quote. Howard Wiseman will probably say, I don't really believe the quote. But if that's your gut reaction, try to come back to it and say, you know, maybe he really does believe it, and I should try to see exactly what he's saying so that what he's saying is consistent with this quote. Here's another thing we take as sacrosanct. It's the idea that probability theory is personalist Bayesian probability theory. That's one name for it. That's Leonard Savage's name for it. And the other is that that quantum theory, in the end, is also going to be a single user theory. Here's an example of what I mean by that. Here's a quote by Dennis Lindley. He says, "The Bayesian subjectivist or coherent paradigm is egocentric." So it is egocentric. "It is a tale of one person contemplating the world and not wishing to be stupid." Technically, that means incoherent, and I'll explain incoherence in a minute or two. "He realizes that to do this, his statements of uncertainties must be probabilistic." So the idea that probability theory is personalist probability, well, it is about one user of it. At any one time, it's about one user of probability theory, and it's about how he should gamble from his perspective on things. That makes it egocentric. So let's now talk about quantum mechanics. The point of view that we're trying to develop is that quantum mechanics, or at least the formal structure of quantum mechanics, and maybe I should be very clear about that, I really do mean only the formal structure of quantum mechanics, is a subset of probability theory. Probability theory comes first, and to probability theory, we add some extra structure. And when we add the extra structure, the idea is we get quantum mechanics. It's not that there's probability theory, and then there is some larger theory called quantum probability. It's just the opposite. Probability theory is first, and on top of it, we add this stuff. And that turns into quantum mechanics. I say the formal structure because I mean Hilbert spaces, and I mean update rules, and I mean POVMs. I mean all of this stuff. I don't mean the actual values of the hydrogen spectrum, like Terry Rudolph was reminding us that in these foundational games, ultimately we're going to have to explain why we get certain values for this and that, and maybe these are the things that pushed us to quantum theory to begin with. So the idea is you won't find within probability theory per se the actual values of hydrogen spectra or helium spectra, but you will find the formal structure of quantum mechanics, the mathematics of quantum mechanics. So those are the three ideas. There is a world external to the agent. That's one idea. The second idea is, nonetheless, probability theory is egocentric. It's agent-centered. And the third idea is that quantum mechanics, the formal structure of it, should be thought of as a structure within probability theory. Putting some of that together, I end up with a cartoon that looks like this. And maybe I shouldn't call it a cartoon, I'll call it a diagram, because it is to be taken really seriously. And I'm going to spend some time talking about it. When I conceptualize, I use that word a lot, maybe too much, when I conceptualize the process of quantum measurement, what I do in my mind is split the world into two parts. One, I'll call the agent. We used to call it observer. I'll call it agent. And I'll make it clear that it's an agent by making him the stick figure that I basically stole from John Wheeler. I break the world into two pieces, the agent and the system that he has some care for, one that he wants to say some things about. The idea of a quantum measurement is that the agent takes an action on the system. Formally, quantum mechanics models it by a positive operator valued measure. So it's, in essence, here's a system and a measurement is hitting it. Take a whack on it. The system plays the role of a catalyst. It leads to something. When I whack the system has some consequences for me. We model that in quantum mechanics by saying that of this set of operators, one of them is a current. One of them corresponds to an experience the agent has, a particular one. So here's a set of these EIs. One of them happens, EK. In this picture, you'll notice that the quantum state, psi, is not sitting over here on top of the object. There's a reason for that. The reason is that we think of the quantum state as purely a function of the agent. In usual developments of quantum mechanics, we think of the quantum state as a function of the system. From the cubist point of view, the quantum state is purely a function of the agent. That's the basic story. Where does measurement happen? If you can ask that question, measurement happens right there, wherever the thing is that you hit. So watch this. This is a measurement, and it happened there. So that's basically the whole story. Now, let me add a little bit more. What if we have two systems? There's two systems. We can take actions on this system. We can take actions on that system. I draw two cubes because that's one action. If this system over here wants an action, it has to wait until the agent walks up to it and gives it a kick. So that's a picture of the world with one agent and two systems, and you can imagine filling it out. A common criticism, here I'll hint at it, a common criticism of this point of view is that if you take such an egocentric description of quantum mechanics, then surely this is solipsism. And I think, why is it solipsism? I've told you that there is the agent and then there is the external world. This is the basic diagram. It's not that. That would be solipsism, that there is just the self and nothing else. You don't see anything else in the diagram. Here you see at least three things in the diagram. So I'd say, just at the outset, I declare I'm not a solipsist. You're not allowed to call me a solipsist. I draw things in my diagrams the right way. What's another issue with it? Well, you might say it's not solipsist, but isn't it leaving out too much? Because certainly we know that there are other agents in the world, and those other agents are using quantum mechanics. And I say, yeah, sure, fine, there are other agents out in the world. Just like I can take my mint copy of Bernardo and Smith's Bayesian theory and walk around and hand it to you, and you can read through it and start applying probability theory and using the rules of probability theory so that you don't make stupid decisions in life, I can take the book of quantum mechanics and hand it to each one of you individually, and from it you'll learn at least some things about not making stupid decisions in life. So it being an egocentric theory doesn't make it a non-universal theory. Everyone should use it. What's another criticism? Well, another criticism is, fine, I'll take all of that, but then it's just instrumentalism, or it's mere instrumentalism. This is the way philosophers insult each other. When one has worked his whole life to develop some system, and another philosopher walks up to him and says, but this is mere instrumentalism. Well, I'd say, no, it's not instrumentalism, because I'm stuck with this fact. I use a particular mathematics for talking about how we should gamble in the quantum world. We use the mathematics of density operators and POVMs and so forth. We don't use another mathematics. To the extent that we use one particular formal structure for quantum mechanics, we're implicitly saying something about the character of the world. If we had used this calculus, whatever that calculus is, we should be able ultimately to infer something about the character of the world. If we had used this calculus, we could say perhaps the character of the world were different, and a different calculus would lead to still a different character of the world. So I look at that. Each one of those terms refer to the agent and his degrees of belief in the Bayesian way, but nonetheless encoded in the structure is some statement about what the world is made of. What is the stuff of the world? What should we strive for? Well, ultimately, if we're doing physics, we should strive to make some statement about the world itself, and not only the agents interacting in the world. So I'll just declare this at the outset. A superior statement about the objective characteristics of our quantum world, of the things in it, would contain no wave functions at all. One would like to end up in a position of that. It could be, and it is, I think, that quantum theory is only about our gambling in this world, but that doesn't exclude us from saying some things about the world itself. And when we do say things about the world itself, it can't involve wave functions, because by assumption, wave functions refer to us, the using agent. Here's the final criticism. It's a quote from John Bell that I got out of one of Travis's papers. I think it's great. I think there are professional problems with quantum mechanics. That is to say, I'm a professional theoretical physicist, and I would like to make a clean theory. And when I look at quantum mechanics, I see that it's a dirty theory. The foundations of quantum mechanics that you find in the books involve dividing the world into an observer and an observed, and you are not told where the division comes. So you have a theory which is fundamentally ambiguous. Well, I think I could imagine meeting on the street a statistician who says, I think there are professional problems with probability theory. That is to say, I'm a professional statistician, and I would like to make a clean theory. And when I look at probability theory, I see that it's a dirty theory. The formulations of probability theory that you find in books involve dividing the world into an agent and an observed, and you're not told where the division comes. So you have a theory which is fundamentally ambiguous. Well, there's irony in that, because you can't really imagine a statistician who would say that. The statistician would say, probability theory is just about, the whole subject matter is just about how an agent should make decisions. It's not its task to question what constitutes an agent. You can't solve this problem within probability theory. What would it take to have a probability distribution? What is the bearer of a probability from the Bayesian point of view? Can a dog be a Bayesian agent? Can a Bayesian spam filter be a Bayesian agent? It doesn't have answers for those things. Nor does it have an answer for the question of how probabilities become updated upon the acquisition of facts. There's a long chain of things that run from the experience at your fingertips up into your brain. If you had expected probability theory to just hold on to its business and stop until all of these questions could be answered, probability theory would have never been used. So what premises Bell's point here is the idea that I think what premises it is that quantum states are real properties of the world, and that measurements are somehow more physical and less indicative of a category distinction in the same way that the Bayesian story is. So let's proceed down this line. Let me tell you what, or give some sense of what I mean by quantum mechanics as an addition to probability theory, and consider what role the Born rule plays within Cubist painting of quantum mechanics. So the usual statement of the Born rule is you're given a quantum state and you're given some measurement, and from the quantum state you derive probabilities according to the usual formula. And often that's called a law of nature, because one says quantum probabilities, or one finds in the philosophic literature a lot, that quantum probabilities are specified by physical law. Well, from our point of view, one shouldn't think of this as a law of nature at all. In fact, the strange point of view that comes up is that one should start thinking of the Born rule not as law of nature, but something we should strive for. What do I mean by that? Well, what I'm meaning is it's not like this, F equals ma. If you're a mass, then Newton's law says you must accelerate according to the force. You have no choice. That's it. If you're something that pretends to be the electromagnetic field, then you should satisfy Maxwell's equations. You have no choice. You can't walk outside of Maxwell's equations. They define what the field is to begin with. Similarly with gravitational fields, they have to obey Einstein's equations. They can't be a little bit to this side of Einstein's equations or a little bit to that side of Einstein's equations. I contrast that point of view, what it's not like, with what we're saying it is. It's more like the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill. Well, the Ten Commandments tell you you shall not kill, but of course people kill all the time. Instead, it's a guide to life. If you want to have a better experience in the afterlife, you shouldn't kill. Thou shalt not steal, and so forth and so on, all the way until you get to the firstling of an ass, thou shalt redeem with a lamb. If there's someone in the audience who understands that one, I would appreciate it. So we're saying that the Born rule is more of the flavor of the Ten Commandments. Technically, in the Bayesian literature, one says that it's normative. What do I mean by a normative law? Well, I look for my example in the definition of probability itself from the Bayesian point of view. So, at least through to some extent for some Bayesians. And here's the idea. A probability is just a number that you write down on a billboard. So, for instance, here is a bookie, and he publishes odds. And what he means by publishing these odds is that he's signing a contract that he will buy or sell a lottery ticket that's worth $1 if the event E occurs for this much money. So if he writes down this list of numbers, it means that he's willing to buy or sell lottery tickets of this structure. Where do the laws of probability come from in something so unstructured as just the idea that these are prices for tickets? Well, it comes from a single principle. The principle, the normative rule, is that one should never declare probability, quote unquote probabilities. One should never declare betting odds, P of E, P of not E, P of E or F, etc., that will lead to a sure loss. So that's the normative rule. One should not do that. One could do it, but one should not do it if you don't want to put yourself in trouble. As Rudiger Schock tried to say in his talk, this rule alone gives you all of the structure of standard probability theory. And I have some examples here. I'm not going to go through those examples, but let me quickly go through this one, the additivity of probabilities. Suppose we have a lottery ticket of this structure, worth $1 if E or F. That's one lottery ticket. Alternatively, we could consider two other lottery tickets worth $1 if E, and another one worth $1 if F. And there are some prices associated with these tickets. This price here is associated with that ticket by definition, and P of E is associated with this one, and P of F is associated with that one. Well, you can just notice that the value of these two tickets is clearly exactly the same as the value of that ticket. One will pay off when the other one does. So it had better be the case that the probabilities, this price plus this price, equals the price for this one. Otherwise, somebody could sell you the two tickets and buy the other one and force you to lose money in a sure way. So that's the idea of a normative law. It leads to probability theory, but we want to come back to quantum mechanics. How can I see that quantum mechanics is a normative rule? Well, I'm going to do that by making a transformation. I want to exchange quantum states for probabilities so that I can put these guys in a common language. And the way I'm going to do that, exchange quantum states for probabilities, is fix some very special measurement in the Bureau of Standards, an informationally complete measurement, one such that if I knew the probabilities for the outcomes of that measurement, I could get rid of the quantum state and just substitute the probability distribution for the measurements. Which measurement should I choose? Well, amongst the whole host of quantum measurements, there's one that appears to be very special. And let me just tell you about it quickly. Suppose you have d squared projection operators on your Hilbert space of dimension d, and they satisfy the property that the overlap between any two of them is a constant. People tend to call this symmetric informationally complete, a symmetric informationally complete set, SIC set. Well, you can prove that if you have d squared projection operators of that structure, they are all linearly independent, and if you renormalize them, they sum to the identity. So they can be used to form a quantum measurement. The Born rule tells you how to calculate the probabilities for such a measurement. And because of the beautiful symmetry up here, it turns out that you can recalculate the density operator rho just by this simple inversion formula in terms of the probabilities. You could use all kinds of informationally complete measurements up in the Bureau of Standards that I told you about a moment ago, but none of them would have this very simple property of inversion except for ones of this structure. So let us put one of these up in the Bureau of Standards and drop the language of quantum states as density operators, and think of quantum states as probability distributions. Now let me consider this kind of problem. Here's the sort of problem that I want to suppose. Suppose you have some von Neumann measurement device. So what I mean by that is a measurement device whose operators, the measurement operators, are an orthogonal set of Frank 1 projection operators. And you'd like to calculate the probability of getting an outcome, J, in that measurement if you throw this quantum system into it. But now, suppose that you're not given the quantum state. The usual thing would be, oh, you just use the Born rule. Suppose you're not given the quantum state, but you're given one of these probabilities that I was talking about. In other words, you have the probability for getting outcome I up in the Bureau of Standards for this very special measurement, the seek, and it's given by that. And suppose further that you're given the conditional probabilities for getting the outcomes J down here, given the outcomes I for up there. If you're not given the density operator, can you still calculate the probabilities for the J's down here? Well, you might imagine that you could, the reason being because we know that these probabilities up here completely specify the quantum state for down here. So maybe you can. But one tool you can't avail yourself of is the law of total probability. So I've given you conditional probabilities. I've given you the conditional for the DJ given the HI. So the HI were the outcomes of the measurement up in the sky. DJ was the measurements on the ground. And you're given the prior probabilities. But you can't avail yourself to the law of total probability for calculating your outcome. Well, there are a couple of ways of saying why you can't. Some people would say, oh, it's because coherence is broken up here, and we're really going this lower path, so we can't use the law of total probability. Or another way of thinking about it is the way Leslie Ballantyne put it in a 1986 paper, and I think Koopman had done so in the 50s as well, that, well, you can't use the law of total probability because hidden in these probability statements are conditionals. In the one case, there is an experiment purely on the ground. In the other case, we travel up to the sky first and then come back down to the ground. So there's a hidden conditional. This is one experiment, and these other probabilities come from two other experiments. Nonetheless, it turns out that for this very special measurement back here, the one that I keep touting, the one that I really like, you can calculate this from these two quantities. But the law is not the law of total probability. It's almost the law of total probability. It's this. So you take the old law of total probability and you just adjust it with a factor that depends upon the dimension of the space and nothing else, and you subtract the factor of 1 and nothing else. And that is the Born rule from this perspective. So from this perspective, the Born rule almost looks like the law of total probability. Well, where did the law of total probability come from? It came from a coherence argument. So this leads us to wonder whether we should take something like this, we quantum Bayesians, whether we should take something like this as an axiom of quantum mechanics itself. Maybe this is a starting point, that to coherence there are additional rules that tell us how to calculate these, I'm going to call them factualized probabilities, probabilities for experiments that we're really going to perform in terms of some counterfactual experiments, experiments that we imagine but that we're not actually going to perform. So that's the idea. Can we see the Born rule as an empirical addition to Dutch book coherence? I've talked about this a whole lot, and at the beginning I alluded to wanting to talk about this, what is real about a system, what is the zing that makes a quantum system interesting, what is it that makes it a good component in a computer, makes a quantum computer. Well, if you travel down this path of wanting to think of the Born rule as an addition to coherence, you can go back to the diagram that we had back here and generalize it somewhat. Act as if you now know nothing about quantum mechanics and just imagine some measurement in the sky that will determine everything. And then you have measurements on the ground for which you can predict their outcomes under special circumstances. And you can try to generalize this and lay down some very general sort of Bayesian axioms Bayesian flavored axioms for this generalized style of law, and you find in the end that there's only one consistent answer that looks a lot like the thing that I showed you a minute ago. You take the old law of total probability, but in this crop up two constants, a Q and a D. And so this is what the generalized formula, and I'll tell you one of these days, if you come back to PI, I'll tell you more about where this comes from. But now you can start to wonder what these terms mean. What is this D? Well, I think I would like to say that the D that crops up is the value of a local beable. It's how much zing your system has. We usually call it the dimensionality of a system. And we think of these as separate systems. But I think, well, okay, here's something. And it's not only does it have a mass and a charge, but it has a certain amount of something else, Hilbert spaceness. It's parameterized by the dimensionality. The other constant, Q, well, it happens to be Q when we have quantum mechanics. It happens to be, or it looks like it could be 1 for real Hilbert space quantum mechanics. This extra factor tells you something about the particular world we live in. So here we have it, I think, in a nutshell. This is somewhat like a law of thought. It's like the law of total probability, but it has some physical constants in it. So here you can start to see it's an empirical addition to our laws of thought. It depends upon the structure of the world, and it even identifies for us some minimal kind of local beables in Bell and Norsen's language. Okay, finally, let me go back to the issue of locality, non-locality. And the first thing I have to emphasize is, what is certainty in this picture? What do you mean when you say probability 1 for something? Well, from this point of view, it means that one will buy or sell a lottery ticket of this structure worth $1 if E, for in fact, $1, full stop. That's all it means. That's all it means. That you will gamble at a certain set of odds. You would gamble your house that E will happen. It does not mean, in particular, that because you will gamble your house on something, that it's true. It doesn't mean that the truth is preexistent. It doesn't mean that the truth is an isolated truth. And I have forgotten what I meant by that. So maybe I'll remember it at the coffee break. Let's apply this idea. Oh, let me read this quote because it's fun. I dug this up in Wittgenstein's book on certainty. Certainty is, as it were, a tone of voice in which one declares how things are, but one does not infer from the tone of voice that one is justified. Well, that's part of the idea that's back here, that probability one is a standalone concept, has not necessarily anything to do with truth. Let's apply this to a little modification that I made to the EPR criterion of reality. The modification, I think, is inessential, but I didn't understand the English of Podolsky's writing of it. I think implicit was the word information, so I added it. Maybe you'll take note with that. We'll see. If without in any way disturbing a system, one can gather the information required to predict with certainty, i.e. with probability equal to unity. Maybe he means by unity something different than I mean by one, but I don't think he does. The value of a physical quantity, then there exists an element of physical reality corresponding to this physical quantity. Most people, I think, who haven't been taken down a personalist Bayesian line would accept that out of hand. How else could you have probability one unless there was an element of physical reality associated with the statement that you're making? Well, for us quantum Bayesians, it just indicates how you'll act, and you can't draw any inferences from it. So let us go to EPR now and take a modern version of it where we consider Q-trits and we consider two measurements that we could perform on, two Q-trits assumed a maximally entangled state. So from my point of view, there is an agent. An agent's degrees of relief are captured by this formal structure, the EPR state, which we know is equivalent to a probability distribution about a measurement up in the sky. And we consider two possible measurements. What I'd like to explore is, well, I tell you that there's no force behind the EPR criterion of reality anymore. But I think of this story that John Wheeler once told the class when I was in his class about how some policemen came and confiscated the fireworks in his house because fireworks were illegal where he was, his summer home on this little island. And he pleaded with the police, why don't you let the old man keep his fireworks? Well, why don't you let the old man keep his EPR criterion of reality? You know, maybe I do want to do that. Maybe I say, okay, there's no logical force behind it anymore, but it seems to me the most reasonable notion that I can imagine. Well, then we put it in the context of EPR, and we see that as long as we consider these two observables that I was talking about, I can play the game of having my elements of reality. I make a measurement here. If I get outcome 2, I suitably translate my measurement to the other side by taking a partial transpose, then I can predict with certainty that I would find outcome 2 over there. So I'll call that an element of reality. I could do it with a different measurement. I'll call that an element of reality. And it looks like we're going down the path of the old EPR argument. But of course, we know that it implodes. Everyone in this audience knows that. Because we could consider many, many observables, say on the order of 44 to 46, in particular ones that don't fit together so that they can be colored, ones like in the old Paris example. Well then, my attempt to apply the EPR criterion of reality ultimately gives rise to a non-colorable set if I apply it to each and every observable I can imagine. So I think I would say that that gives me a statement that I can chew upon. I'd say, what have I learned from this situation, just as I've learned from Bell, actually, if I interpret Bell in cubist terms, it's that we can say something about the old question of whether measurement reveals a pre-existing but unknown value, or whether it, in some sense, goes toward creating the very value. I'd say, well, we have the former, the latter, whichever that is, the second. So here's where we stand. Howard Wiseman is a personalist Bayesian. Chris Fuchs is a personalist Bayesian. That means we use probability theory per se in exactly the same way, or at least I think Howard and I do. I think we're in enough agreement on that. We use probabilities in a personalist Bayesian way, but that doesn't tell us at the outset anything about the character of what the probabilities are about. There are two possibilities for what the probabilities could be about. They could be about states of pre-existent reality, or they could be about the consequences of measurement interactions. And I feel by the conceptual examination of two objects as two objects, I am led to that one, not that one. So in closing, let me come back to what the talk is supposed to be about, an analysis of what happens when we have entangled pairs. Let's consider what I call the pure Einstein case. It was the thing that Einstein was considering before EPR. There's a maximally entangled pair here. That means that's Alice's degrees of belief with respect to a Bureau of Standards about these two systems. Let me suppose that she measures one half of the EPR pair, updating to some quantum state psi for the other pair. What does that mean? Does it mean that something was forced to happen on the other side? I say, no. Remember where measurements happen. Measurements happen right here. So there's a notion of locality built into the very notion of measurement as expressed in the important diagram at the beginning. All it means is if she were to now walk, if she were to now walk to the other side and measure this one, in other words, whack it in exactly the same way as she had whacked that one, she would expect the same consequence. Namely, she would expect to get this outcome in this two-valued measurement. She'd expect to get that one. She would bet her life on it. That's what certainty means. And once again, I'll just emphasize, it doesn't mean that she has to accept that there is an element of reality corresponding to the measurement outcome. Because, well, who's making the probability assignment one? Alice is making it. There's no one else in the picture out here to make any other probability assignments. There's no God in this picture looking down upon it. It's just Alice. Let's consider the scenario of Bell inequality tests. It's often said that Bell inequality violations can be tested in a theory-independent way. That's what's so powerful about them, that they make no reference to a theory of how the world is. And then we see that quantum phenomena violate these inequalities. So look at the very powerful statement that's been made. I don't buy that. I don't buy it for this reason. Suppose I were to describe Bell inequality tests in these cubist terms. We have now an Alice, and we have a Bob. We have an entangled pair in between them. Let me look at everything from Alice's perspective. I could take either perspective. I'm going to take Alice's perspective. Let me suppose that she believes quantum mechanics. And all I mean by that is that she has taken the book that's analogous to this Bayesian theory book and says, I'm going to structure my gambles and degrees of belief according to the rules it sets forth. So from Alice's perspective, there's one physical system over here, the other qubit, and there's Bob. He's a physical system from her perspective. From her perspective, he's not an agent. He's just some other collection of carbon and oxygen and whatever else is in our bodies, a little bit of phosphorus in mine. So here's Alice. There's two physical systems over there. She has accepted quantum mechanics. She searches her soul and says, what kinds of degrees of belief should I have? Well, she writes one down for this entangled pair, and she writes one down for Bob. Suppose she can really push it to the level of writing down a density operator, rho Bob. It's that. Now, believing that Bob interacts with his qubit, believing that there's something happening over there, she writes down a unitary operation to evolve her degrees of belief. So this is only making a statement about her degrees of belief. Now she measures on her side of the world, and she updates her quantum state for this system in the purple circle. Well, it's generally an entangled state. So this leaves us now questioning, I'm almost finished. This leaves us now questioning this. Where in Alice's beliefs, i.e. her quantum states, is any notion of a click going on at Bob's side? Her degrees of belief are about what will happen when she whacks the system. Her degrees of belief are not, in this point of view, in the cubist point of view, her degrees of belief are not about what is internal to the stuff over there. It's not internal to what's in the black box. It's about what will come about if she interacts with. Her quantum states do not pierce those systems. They only refer to what she believes will be the consequences of her later interactions with Bob. So as best I can pin it down, the real thing that drives, and I think Nicolas Ghyssen made this point recently in a paper where he said something or soft option, I forget the first part of the title, is that behind the Bell inequality derivation, and he didn't quite say it in these terms, is that for every player in it, they have a degree of belief about what was actually happening over there. From this point of view, we don't have those degrees of belief. Quantum theory gives us degrees of belief for what will happen to us. So I'd say that's what it looks like from this perspective. And with that, let me just close by pointing out somewhat tongue-in-cheek that this work was supported in part by the U.S. Office of Naval Research. And once a year, they make me come and give a report. And there's a standard question on the forum. What are you trying to accomplish? And I dream of the day that I will be bold enough, probably just as the grant ends, to read them this quote from Will Durant's History of Philosophy that I have taken quite a liking to. And I'll just put it in the background. The value of a pluriverse, you can wonder what that means, the value of a pluriverse as compared with a universe lies in this, that where there are cross currents and warring forces, our own strength and will may count and help decide the issue. It is a world where nothing is irrevocably settled and all action matters. A monistic world is for us a dead world. In such a universe, we carry out willy-nilly the parts assigned to us by an omnipotent deity or a primeval nebula. The people across the street believe in the primeval deity, and the people here at Perimeter Institute, as far as I can tell, believe in the primeval nebula. And not all our tears can wipe out one word of the eternal spirit. It is a finished universe. Individuality is a delusion. In reality, the monist assures us we are all bits of one mosaic substance. But in an unfinished world, we can write some lines of the parts we play, and our choices mold in some measure the future in which we have to live. In such a world, we can be free. It is a world of chance and not of fate. Everything is not quite, and what we are or do may alter everything. So when they ask me, what are you trying to accomplish, I'd like to say, I'm trying to put some flesh and some physics into that quote, and I think the cubist move in Quantum Foundations is a move in that direction. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. That was very, very entertaining, interesting.
I wrote part of it for you, you know.
Sorry?
I wrote part of it for you, you know.
I can appreciate you want to be free, if that seems to be what you're saying at the end. But I guess my question is, why should I take you seriously when you don't take me seriously?
Ooh, that's a good one. Oh, my gosh. The toughest question first.
That wasn't meant to be a personal question. It was meant to be.
No, that's a serious question.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in this talk, I didn't go down my. So the one thing that I was emphasizing is the fact that I want a little privacy in the bedroom, and I don't want anyone else's hidden variables knowing about mine. But one, you know, I could also have said, how odd it strikes me that nature... Well, you see, that's an example of nature being a little vicious to us. Things happen that we can't see and that don't really play a role other than our fuzzy feeling. But here's another way in which it seems nature would delude us. We can't signal with Bohmian mechanics, say. And one makes excuses or apologies or says, look how natural this is. But I wonder, isn't this really a conspiracy? So you can give a story of it, but in the end, it always feels like a conspiracy to me, that there is no local causality, that something here affects there. And if you knew the hidden variable, you would call it signaling, as Chaslov did yesterday. But you don't know the hidden variable, so you don't call it signaling, but still something here affects something there. And I think, damn it, why can't I harness that? God put it in the world, but yet he doesn't let me quite reach it. That bothers me. Similarly, I could think, well, when I'm in the laboratory and I walk in with some well-defined operational procedure, my well-defined operational procedures always refer to what my measurements mean for me in pragmatist language. And so here I've got a well-defined operationalist procedure. We call it a measurement. And then you, with a God's eye view, come along and say, no, it didn't really mean that at all. It meant something else. And the something else refers to pieces of the world far away. In God's eye, these measurements don't quite have the same meaning that they do for me. That also seems like a conspiracy. So I have little reasons like this that lead me to think that that's going down the wrong path. And then, of course, there's probably just psychology something in my upbringing that makes me think, I don't want to end up with a block universe. I don't want to end up with a deterministic universe. And it looks to me like quantum mechanics opens a possibility in that direction. And in the end, it's Darwin. You go your path, and I go my path, and we see which of us survives.
So maybe if I just pick up on the last point about, maybe it was the second last point, about conspiracy theory. I mean, so isn't it somehow in your approach, isn't it like a conspiracy, the fact that you refuse to say that you, you know, believe in the reality of other people's outcomes, and yet you act as if, when you meet them, you act as if they really had outcomes.
I don't think that's a fair characterization, and I've tried to answer you in email. The idea here is that quantum mechanics is a circumscribed theory. It has its boundaries. And it's referring to my experiences. It's not referring to your experiences. You can ask the question, can a bigger theory be found that would allow me to refer to your experiences? And I haven't denied that. Maybe one can. Maybe it fits within the broader framework of Bayesianism. But I refuse to call it a hidden variable theory, because the usual understanding of hidden variable theories is that the variables are out there, independent of the agent. And in my diagram that I love to show off to everyone, you'll notice that maybe you could use hidden variableist terms to say what you mean by that. But those hidden variables are going to refer, in part, to the agent himself. And saying, oh, that's just a contextual hidden variable theory does me no good, because usually when people think of contextual hidden variable theories, part of the context is the box that's out there, the measuring device. And I say, if you go to your logical conclusion, you're going to be carried all the way back to the Bayesian, to the agent. So that's what I'm thinking there.
Okay, Mike Towler. The group I come from in Cambridge, they spend all their time doing quantum mechanics practically, essentially by solving the Schrodinger equation. Okay. Now, in all my 14 years there, I've never seen them calculating probabilities or talking about measurement or observers. They just calculate energies and possibly derivatives of energies, and they work out dynamics. And they answer questions like, what happens when two molecules come together and interact? So in their view, quantum mechanics just tells you what the world does. It evolves according to the laws of quantum mechanics. Now, these molecules could have been in a rocky pool of prebiotic soup on a proto-Earth 3.5 billion years ago, when there were no agents or observers. So I guess my first question is, at what point in the last 3.5 billion years did quantum mechanics stop being statistical mechanics with a non-classical dynamics and become a Bayesian theory about measurements by observers? And my second question is...
Now, let me answer the first one first.
Okay.
The point of view here is that if you don't have agents, and you don't have quantum states. Now, the way you just described things is as if the chemist who could write down his wave functions and, you know, doing what he does, doing quantum chemistry, he always uses wave functions in all of his calculations. And so I know, or at least I think I understand, that the tension here is that certainly there was a universe before there were agents, before there were people. And you're asking, what was it doing? And the claim here is that quantum mechanics, to the extent that it's told us anything about that, is only through a couple of little knobs. I showed them as Q and D. You take the agent out of the picture, wave functions disappear out of this picture. It doesn't mean that the world disappears from this picture. So what was it doing before we were here? I don't really know. The only thing I know is that I can look out at the stars and I can use what I see to update my probability assignments for this or that. But the only thing that I'm doing in that game is updating my probability assignments for this or that.
Okay, so my second question, which was, how can degrees of belief be manipulated by optical instruments as they apparently appear to be in matter wave optics?
How can they be what?
You can manipulate the wave field, the thing represented by the wave function, by optical instruments. You can reflect, diffract, interfere, do stimulated emission with it. And that's called matter wave optics. Mm-hmm. In order for that to happen, this wave field must objectively exist in order to act and be acted upon. Do you not agree?
No, I think that I can show you the opposite with a coin. Let's take some coin that you flip, and for whatever reason, you don't look at the outcome, but you think it's 75% heads and 25% tails. You don't look at the outcome. And then you hand it off to David Merman, and you think, oh, he's a cankerous old soul. There's some probability that he'll flip it. and you take your degree of belief about what he might do to it, and apply it to your prior probability. And now he hands it back to you. So look, your probabilities have changed. And it happened because he had some interaction with the system. And you have some beliefs about what he, how he will interact with the system. Same way with quantum mechanics. The only thing I can't quite point to is this hidden variable. I mean, in my coin model, I had a hidden variable. That's the only change.
So Anthony Valentini, so let me start by agreeing with something that you said reply to Wiseman. I mean, I agree completely that if you have de Broglie-Bohm theory with equilibrium probabilities, so that there's no possibility of signaling, no possibility of ever using the underlying non-locality, that is conspiratorial. If you can never measure the details of the trajectories because you're stuck in equilibrium, that would be, you know, there's something almost unscientific about that. So I agree with you there, and I think that but at the same time, the de Broglie-Bohm theory itself tells you, given the fact that the universe has had a long and violent astrophysical history, under very plausible assumptions, you can see that, well, things are naturally going to relax to this equilibrium state. And it is just a contingency that we're stuck in that state, and we ought to try to see if there's any deviation from it. But now let me get on to where I don't agree with you. Let me say something else that I think, to an extent, I agree, that it could be useful to look at quantum mechanics as a probability theory. It might turn out that that's interesting. But it still leaves open some of the questions that bother a lot of us. And so here's where I really disagree with you. So going back to your Bell quote, you know, where Bell is saying, well, this is an ill-defined theory, you've got this notion of a system, an observer, an apparatus, and these are not completely well defined. I think you said something about, well, this is assuming that the quantum state is real. I don't think that's really the issue. What Bell is really trying to get at here, and in other quotes, is that he's asking, look, we all agree when we're really being serious that there is a reality macroscopically, tables and chairs and people in this room. And he is asking, what happens when we go to smaller scales? You know, what is real all the way down? I mean, put just in a very simple example, if I have an electron in a large box, what is going on in there? Is there a mass in some small region? Is there a mass spread over the box? Is there no mass? What is there in that box? And what I want to say to you is, I think, look, if your program succeeds in some sense, it's still going to leave open these questions. I mean, in reply to Towler, I mean, in a specific case of what was happening millions of years ago, you know, your answer is, well, I don't know what was happening when we weren't here. But, you know, without getting into issues about the reality of the past, let's just talk about a box in the lab, or maybe two boxes, and there's an electron in one of these boxes. Mm-hmm. And we seem to agree that in some sense it has a mass. Mm-hmm. Where is that mass? Is it in one box or the other? If we open the boxes and the electron flies out and hits a detector,
what
happens in between?
Okay,
so that's the end of my comment. Okay.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that we will, at the end of the day in physics, get to some finite story of what's happening in the world?
So I don't really know.
So will there be one magical equation at the end that gets it all?
I don't know. What I do know is that we agree that there are in this room various objects. Okay, and I'm just asking a question about what happens if I look at the... You yourself said something about people being made of oxygen and phosphorus atoms. If I actually look carefully at one of these atoms, why is it that when I'm looking at a larger scale, say at the level of cells, there is this notion of a definite state? There is a cell here, and there's another cell there, and this is what it's doing. When I get to a smaller scale, we reach this sort of cloudy, there's no definite description of what is happening. And the problem is the borderline, and this is really Bell's point, that where is the borderline between the macro, where we have sort of definite states?
Yes. Okay, stop right there. Stop right there. So I could similarly say of the probabilist, he says, where is the borderline where I stop using a description that is about my ignorance, and I imagine that I'm on the little particle traveling around, and I know the truth value of its position.
Yes,
he
that's
doesn't
fair.
Ask that.
That's fair
because
enough.
Because it's not a well-defined question from his point of view.
Oh.
From his point of view, he's talking about his ignorance of what is.
Yes.
He can't even imagine himself getting on the. Yes. So I write down a probability distribution for some proposition. What you're asking in the end is, how does the agent in Bayesian probability theory throw away all this ignorance and hop onto the proposition itself, if I can use this metaphorically? In other words, you're asking, where does the... You imagine that there's a boundary between the proposition and the ignorance. And I say, well, they're two different categories. They're just two different categories. And Bell's question comes from the idea that we take two categories and treat them as one.
Well, look, I agree with you.
But I should probably take another question.
For a probability theorist, the question I'm asking is not relevant. I agree with you. But we're not just probability theorists. We're scientists. We've agreed that there is a structure of the world at a certain level. It's been probed down to smaller and smaller scales. We've reached a point where suddenly there's no clear answer to what the structure is. A probability theorist doesn't ask those questions. It's not his job, but it's our job.
Thank you for your question. We're going over time, aren't we?
Dean, how are we going on time? Do you want to take another question?
So I like the program, sort of understanding quantum theory more and more as a probability theory and, in the Bayesian way and so on. But it seems to me that the assumption that of no realism plays no role whatsoever, just as it plays no role in classical probability theory, as you put it up there on the quote. So here's my bold statement.
No microscopic
realism plays no role in this program. There's no crucial, implication of that in here. Because if you develop this program, it is still consistent with the hidden variable theory in the future. So here's my bold claim. This notion of macroscopic unrealism will always be devoid of implications, and that's always going to be the case. So it's not really a scientific, assumption to make. I can't think of a single case where the idea that electrons aren't real has empirical consequences. So that's sort of my question.
There was a question.
This is just... Well, to make it... Here's the question. Assuming that electrons aren't real, they don't have definite properties, or microscopic things doesn't have properties, what is the empirical consequence of that? Is this just pure philosophy that has no instrumental or, experimental consequences? Because I do see that what you're doing is, it's not even you may be motivated by that, but in the end it's independent of that. I could use your work in the future, but I like microscopic realism.
Sure.
The same is not true, though, with hidden variable theories.
The claim here is that there's a realism of the sort that you would like, but it's a thinner handle than you would like. So, for instance, take this equation. So the idea is that this equation is empirically motivated. When you write down these constants Q and D, you're making a hypothesis about what the subject matter is. I'm dealing with electrons, and electrons have D equal 2, for instance. That's a hypothesis in the usual sort of sense as when I say, here's a bowling ball, and I hypothesize that its mass is 2 pounds. Or, well, I don't know how much a bowling ball is, 5 pounds, something like that. It's of the same variety. And then the idea is this hypothesis that one makes of the world, that's realism in the usual sense, plays a role in how I should structure my probabilities. What do the probabilities refer to? They refer to things that happen to me. That's not realism in the usual sense. So it's a mixture of the two, and it's an attempt to push to see if this leads to anything. In the end, can you be a Bohmian and still adopt all these equations? Of course you can, with hindsight. With hindsight, you can. If you're a Bohmian at the outset, you probably wouldn't be pushed to search for these equations. So with all of our philosophies, your Bohmianism is leading you to ask certain questions, and my Bayesianism is leading me to ask certain questions. I don't end up asking the same questions that you or Howard Wiseman is asking, and you guys don't ask the same questions that I do. But of course, with hindsight, we can both push ourselves into each other's picture if we want. But that's with hindsight.
Yeah, so my overall feeling is that this notion of realism or anti-realism in the end is a red herring for foundations of quantum mechanics. In the end, I'll be able to use your work, and it's independent. I could be a realist, non-realist. In the future, maybe hidden variable theories comes along, new structure, they make new predictions, and similarly, you may take on an anti-realist point of view. So I guess my question is, why is this really an interesting question about realism and not realism? I think one could just drop that altogether and just probe physics, and that's it. Now, you're probing quantum probability theory, and that's excellent. Other people, they're probing, well, they want to know about microscopic structure. I mean...
Well, I agree with half of your statement, that at the end, you can explain anything in realist terms or anti-realist terms. But my only point is that there are pragmatic distinctions in motivations. And I've got mine, and you've got yours. I just tried to present the point of view here as best I could. I tried. Maybe I stayed up too long last night, and I got a little grumpy in the process.
I think it's coffee time. So thank Chris again.